sessions in Singleton, we're up there twice a year for medieval conferences, and there are a lot of people in Buffalo, and a few people in Albany.
You know my son, didn't you?
Oh, yes, I knew Drew quite well. And the people I knew in Albany were scholars rather than administrators, whereas the other two campuses, I knew the administrators too. So I was not ever on any state lab committee. But I had lots of connections through very political, sort of medievalists on those campuses. And I traveled to those campuses a lot. I gave papers at those campuses in upstate and so forth. When I was provost for humanities and fine arts during the period 1976 to 78, I believe. During that period, I had a lot of struggling with central administration. And I knew the people up there quite well. And that was easy because there weren't many of them.
Who in central administration should I interview? Because thus far, I have interviewed nobody in the central administration who is there now.
You should interview Jerry Commissar.
So, Commissar, all right.
I think he's maybe the only one left.
I haven't interviewed Larry Murray
mm-hmm.
and John Foster.
Mm-hmm.
Stevens and George Dudley of the Construction Fund.
Mm-hmm. You would have trouble interviewing the people who were there in the mid-70s because they didn't do much. They didn't last long. They were kind of passing through and they were completely undermined in everything they did. The real length was the personal paper study group was the kind of lap over of the Rockefeller administration. Rockefeller was very attuned to what Sullivan was doing. He was building a high-level research school. And so he understood the economic value as well as the intellectual value of such things.
Well, he was a Phi Beta Kappa from
Dartmouth. Yeah, sure. Yeah. He also had an industrialist mentality. He wasn't there just to manage an organization. He was there to build things. And that's what Study Group was there for, not to be managed, but to build things. And so it was a great loss when we lost him. Number 14, once you feel you had accomplished at Study Group by 1971, by 1971 I had remade the English department's medieval program. We had made some major changes in the doctoral program outside of medieval. It was very disorganized at the time, and we essentially gave it some structure. We had put into place procedures for bringing in first-rate graduate students, because there had been some good ones before, but we essentially raised the quality of the top half. I did some of my best writing in that period. The library helped me there. I had a couple of students I brought with me to Stony Brook who were sort of the core of people to talk to, and that kind of thing. And I hadn't yet started serving on committees. I think 1971 I probably came on to the library committee. And that was the beginning of my committee work. And in fact, that was my entree into administration.
Was John Smith the librarian then, or was it Roscoe Rouse?
Well, I was on the search committee that hired John Smith.
You were, I see.
And then an interim librarian, whose name escapes me at the moment, who went to the National Institute of Health. The library was very poorly run at the time I came. It was run from a librarian's point of view and not from a scholar's point of view or even a student's point of view.
Did you know Ross Rouse?
No, he's before my time. And the library, one of the reasons I got on the library committee was I'd always been on the library committee. Even when I was a student, I was on the library committee. And then, please stop the tape, okay?
Sure.
That's right. And so I got on the library committee because it's very useful for a medievalist, and particularly a bibliographer, to know the librarians in great detail and to help them. And eventually I came to chair that committee. And I think we did a lot to improve the reference room in particular, and to improve collection development. And I was on the search committee eventually that got John Smith, who was a first-rate librarian, in my opinion.
Yeah, which he's done very well.
Yeah.
Very well indeed.
And what we never could do anything was the circulation department, which was run by people who were not oriented to students, and regarded students as a pain in the ass and treated them as such. And we just never got anywhere with that at all. And so that was really the start of whatever visibility I had at Stony Brook, because I remember Sidney Gelber sent Jim McKenna over to the library committee to see what they were talking about. And I had become chair of it by then. And I think that's how I came to the administration's attention, as someone who could organize things. And we had one other unsuccessful effort. We tried to start up an anchored undergraduate library collection, 100,000 volumes, non-circulated, and so forth. And about the time we convinced people that was a good idea, the money ran out. So we convinced everybody, but there were no resources for it. The final question is, can you name individuals who did things that were important for the future development of the university as a whole or some part of it? Well, I think the most important person was John Toll. John was a man of real vision, and he was a man who could put his stamp on the university. It looked like John Toll's school, and so which meant that it was built in a hurry with a lot of money, and not a great deal of style, but with tremendous talent and energy, and so forth. And I think that the present status of Stony Brook has to be attributed to John, of the people who were in office at the time I was there. Yeah, there are people before my time, like Robert Jordan, who's a friend of mine, who was being
raised. Where is he now?
He's at the University of British Columbia, Vancouver.
Vancouver.
Yeah. And I think he laid down a pretty firm base of in the graduate school. But he left before I came. The other person I would have
to say in the graduate school or in the undergraduate school?
The graduate school.
Graduate school.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
He sort of started off the graduate school's ways of thinking about itself in relation to the department. And all this happened before I came, but it was very firmly in place.
So this was English, you're talking English.
Well, no, I'm talking about the whole university.
I see.
And the odd thing was that he was an English professor. Now, Herbert Weisinger is another person who was very influential on the shape of the place. And one thing I would say about Herbert is he had good taste in people. He saw to it that the right people got hired, and he also saw to it that the wrong people got out of office. He was one of the last people at Stony Brook I saw who could get a chairman out of office. He needed to be gotten out. And he was a very odd man. He was a very nasty man in some ways. But on the other hand, he stood up for quality. And he knew how to recognize it when he saw it. And he knew how to convince other people that it was there. He had an unfortunate kind of driving mentality. He believed that you could motivate people by pushing them with numbers. And so he would use statistics to push the departments around, and demanding of them that they raise their enrollment at the graduate level. And that didn't work at all. And that was one of Herbert's problems, that he couldn't make his enrollment targets. In 9 years in office, he made them twice, the first year and the last. But he was very instrumental, so far as I could tell, in some of the better hiring in the English department and the better hiring in the humanities.
Who stands out in the English department?
No. Well, somebody's already sent them. And Jack Ludwig. Cason, while he was there, and oddly enough, hiring Irving Ridner was his idea and was a very good one. Irving brought a lot of visibility to the department. He didn't live long enough, that's the problem. And he also brought Richard Levin, not Levine, Levin, the great Shakespeare scholar. And I think he had a hand in hiring Tom Maresca. And there's certainly less people in the English department now. Paul Bellin, the chairman of the East Department. And in my time, Paul was the best department chairman we had. Very much a builder, very much aware of how to argue for resources, very aware of what your surroundings could do for you. Get the East Department from moving in the library, which is one of the best things that ever happened.
You kept them from moving in?
Yeah, one of the things that's always been going on in the university is that the administration's always trying to move the English department into the library, you see. And if you do that, then they turn into a kind of amorphous lump. Their offices would be scattered all over the place. They wouldn't be able to get into the building after 10 o'clock at night. They wouldn't be able to get into their offices certain times on the weekends and so forth. So one of the games the English department played the whole time I was there was keeping itself out of the library, you see. And Bellin was kind of set the tone in that. He was very good at it. I want to add parenthetically that I'm sounding very negative about all this. I thought that this was a grand, splendid times. We accomplished a lot. Had a wonderful time. Did some of the best writing I ever did. And my chief regret is that the people who were running the place, except for John Toll, had so little talent that they didn't realize the potential. And they didn't build on the base that John had laid down. And I think if Studybook had kept going in the way it was going in 1971, it would be one of the major schools of America today. But unfortunately, after John Toll left, a lot of the weaker administrators came to full power. Mm-hmm. And that stopped a lot of things in my opinion. I've answered all your questions. What was I to ask?
I have felt that I'll put it another way. The social sciences have a building. The sciences have individual buildings. The humanities have a building labeled humanities, which has the English department in it.
Mm-hmm.
Philosophy is in the old physics building.
Mm-hmm.
Religion has been moved from the old physics to the old chemistry building.
Mm-hmm.
The languages are in the library. The humanities are scattered from hell to breakfast.
Mm-hmm.
No thought has been given, as far as I can see, to the advantages inherent in association among minds in more than one discipline. And as long as the place is run by scientists, the humanities problem, as I see it as a problem, is not going to be addressed.
Mm-hmm.
Would you go about either assessing the problem or doing something about it?
Well, John Toll had the answer. It was a typical John Toll answer. He believed that if you put people in the same building, that they would inevitably work together. And one of his pet projects was the Humanities Tower, which was a humanities building with all the humanities departments in it that would have been located between the present humanities building and the library, up in that big square. And that was very high on his priority list, and it wasn't built because the money essentially ran out when Rockefeller died. And I think that would have helped a lot, but the real problem in humanities was not their being scattered. That was just a symptom more than a cause. The real cause, I think, was very, very poor leadership. A series of just very weak chairs, in important departments. Some very odd developments. And
you see, the leadership was essentially leadership, the top leadership was leadership not by people in the humanities,
mm-hmm.
by people in the sciences,
mm-hmm.
who were perfectly satisfied with the humanities as they were,
mm-hmm.
who didn't have imagination. That you obviously have,
mm-hmm.
be and do for the institution.
Well, I mean, let's say appropriated the money in the right times. Remember that one of Sidney Gelbert's innovations was to have the budget in the faculty lines driven by enrollment. And the reason he put that in was that the sciences were getting all the lines at one time, and humanities had all the students. And so one of the reasons that was true was that the time I came there, 80% of the freshmen were pre-med. And they were washing out of pre-med at a tremendous rate, and they tended to wash over into the humanities. It's perfectly fine. They were very, very bright students, very high verbal scores and so forth. And so the humanities were getting the money, and they were getting the faculty lines. It's just that they kept hiring the wrong people. And
who did the appointing?
Well, essentially, they kept hiring their friends. You see.
No effort to comb the disciplines.
Well, remember that even I came to Stony Brook's attention because I was about preached for it.
Yeah.
You see. And, I mean, that if you've got the friends of high talent and character and ability, hiring your friends can be a good idea. But if your friends are kind of weak sisters, people with no vision and not a lot of energy, then you end up with a faculty with no vision and not a lot of energy. And it was compounded by the fact that we kept getting people in leadership positions who could not organize, could not build, and essentially could not hire people. That was what kept theater down for so long. Theater had no leadership whatever in the entire time I was there, from 1969 to the time I left in 84.
Who was the chairman?
Leonard Auerbach, most of the time. And he was one of Sidney Gelbert's appointees. Sidney kept him in office. He was not a builder, and so forth. When I became provost, one of my duties, I thought, was to take charge of the new fine arts building, which was then being built. And I discovered that we had an $11 million building coming on the line, and there'd been no planning whatsoever of staffing it. The art department and the theater department had no discussions whatever of the faculty needs. And I think we had something like 11 people in the theater department going into a building that had 5 theaters in it. And there'd never been any discussions about the kind of support staff and so forth. And I remember one of the first things I did was I had a series of meetings with the theater department to get them to draw up a document of how to staff the new building. And I took it into a meeting with Sidney Gelbert and his staff, and it very quickly became apparent to me that Sidney and his staff had not read the document. And Sidney then conducted a half-hour critique of the first paragraph of the document. And it was so savage and so ignorant that it probably set the theater department back 2 years in its development. The staff kind of trickled in. There was no planning and so forth. But that was typical. I mean, I had to go over and provide the leadership for the theater department. It just simply didn't have any at all. The same thing was true of art. No planning in art. Jacques Tulmaine was the chair. He didn't want to be the chair. He did everything to get out of the chair. And Sidney Gelbert just kept him in there. And I think the reason Sidney kept those people in there was that he wanted to control the arts department. And so he kept in people who would do what he told them to do. In the music department, he went out and hired himself Leo Treitler. He was one of the finest academic leaders I've ever met. I mean, a great vision, and wonderful scholar, wonderful builder, and he really had taste. Well, remember one day, Leo came over to me and he said, "Don, I've just lost my bassoonist, and I want you to appropriate the money to hire the number two bassoonist in New York City." I said, "Leo, that's not like you. You usually hire the number one bassoonist in New York City." And he said, "Well, the guy who quit was the number one bassoonist." And that was typical of Leo. I mean, Leo, besides his qualities as a scholar, also had great taste in academic hiring. And so he just hired himself a brilliant department. And if we'd had that kind of leadership in art and theater, Stony Brook would be one of the major powers in the arts. in American universities at the moment. But it was not to be. I mean, they got the building. They got the gorgeous building.
Yes, to gorgeous building. The auditorium only holds 1,100. Do you know the story of the time?
Well, I gather that the...
West was 15, I think, something.
Yes, and the problem, of course, is that you need an auditorium of a certain size in order to get certain orchestras.
Yeah.
And the hall was too small. We needed that before the building was finished. And the fortunate thing about it was they built two halls, a little one and a big one.
Yeah.
And the mistake was not making the big one a little bigger.
That's right.
Yeah.
And who, I wonder whose mistake was that?
I don't know. That had been done before I came into office. The planning for that building, I think, was done in 1974, and I wasn't privy to that, unfortunately. I had been involved in building planning in Stony Brook, and in Virginia before I came. I remember we built a new building for the English department, and I was the summer chairman, and they called me into a meeting called the Key Meeting. And the new building was going to open in the fall, and they had a meeting with the architects to decide how the key patterns would be done for keying the doors. And I remember in the meeting I asked them why the faculty members were being given keys to elevators. And the architect said, well, there's no way to get to the fourth floor except by elevator. There are no stairways. And so, since those are faculty offices, we have to give them keys. And they said, how are the students going to get up there and talk to them? And they hadn't thought about that. You see, the analogy was that Stony Brook, nobody had ever shown any of the plans for the new theater building to the theater department. They didn't bother to do that. And one of the things I did was I got the plans spread out in front of the faculty, and the first thing they noticed was that there was no box office. But that was typical of the way things were done at Stony Brook. Nobody bothered to ask the people who were going to inhabit the building what the building should be like.
Now, whose responsibility was that? Was that the local administration's responsibility, or was it the central office's responsibility?
Well, I think no matter who was assigned it, it was the responsibility of the local administration. My opinion, that would have been the responsibility of the executive vice president, Alexander Parr. He was in charge, essentially, of getting buildings up. He was in charge of long-range planning and so forth, and he was John Tuttle's alter ego, and not much of a mixer with the faculty outside of the hard sciences.
Yeah.
And I doubt if he'd ever talked to a theater faculty in his life, but he could have named one. Okay. And so there were lots of little things like that. But there are other things like that even in science buildings. We built a new math building, for instance. One group of professors felt that their offices were too small. And so they worked with Alexander Palm, and they got their offices enlarged. And people down at the other end of the hall then thought that their offices were too small. So they got their offices enlarged. And then the first group wanted theirs a little bigger. The second group wanted theirs a little bigger. And one group wanted a closet and so forth. And so they kept pushing their walls towards each other. And before they knew what they'd done, they'd eliminated the math library. Which was between the two sets of offices. And so luckily we caught that one. We had to go back and redesign the building a little bit.
I'm learning a lot from interviewing people.
Mm-hmm. What is your time frame? Are you trying to stop in 1971?
Roughly, that's when it's not hard and fast,
mm-hmm.
but that's when Glass left. Also, when I left,
mm-hmm.
And while. I think that we didn't want to bite off more than perhaps 15 years or 16 years. But I'm getting overruns, and I'm glad.
Mm-hmm.
think Gould left about that time.
Mm-hmm. The story of Stony Brook, in my opinion, up to 1971, is essentially two layers of leadership. If John Toll had had a little better taste in the people he hired to run things, the people that succeeded him would have run it the way he ran it. And then I think the school would have gone a long ways. As you know, I had doubts about the way he treated people, but he was good at getting the university up and making it ambitious about itself. And the difficulty was that he was such a prima donna that he wouldn't develop leaders. He said, he wouldn't let anybody else be a leader. And so when he left the University of Maryland, he left a gigantic vacuum. And I remember there was a period in the 70s when there were five major administrative positions open for over 2 years.
Where? You mean that Stony Brook?
Yes.
Which ones?
Well, there was the Vice President for Liberal Studies, essentially the head of Artist Intelligence. The Executive Vice Presidency was open. I think the undergraduate deanship was open. There were two others, I forget what they were.